Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by TechNode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs. I'm Elliot Zagman, and with me is a co-host for whom I am eternally thankful. It's James Hall.
Oh, thank you. Is that because Thanksgiving's coming up?
Happy Thanksgiving week.
Thankful for you, too.
Yeah.
That's sweet.
Are you having any turkey in Beijing this week?
We're doing turkey. We're doing group dinner, turkey, family nice. Stuff. Yep.
This is my first American Thanksgiving in a very long time.
Oh, yeah. Thanksgiving, I love it. I think it's one of the better fun ones, but COVID stuff, can't go back. And here's a quick disclaimer. We're talking about earnings today, which means we're digging into some companies. We may say positive stuff. We may say negative stuff. That means whatever, regardless of whether it's positive or negative, it's not investment advice, so go somewhere else for that, or do it yourself, do your own research.
And if it's earnings, you know what else it means?
Yeah, we got a special guest from...
It means that we're joined by Michael Norris. Michael, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you both. Although it's not an Australian holiday, I do wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you. Thanks. Do you have anything that would be like comparable? I mean, like maybe do you have anything that's like an Australian, you know, like a day where everybody gets together, just eats a bunch of stuff?
Not quite. I think that Thanksgiving is a rather special holiday. I like the premise. I wish we adopted it, but we don't have it. So there you go.
All right. Okay, cool. Well, let's get into things. I think that there's not a whole lot for investors to be thankful for what we're talking about today. We're going to look at at Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, you know, the old BAT, and none of which really, had very robust earnings. Maybe we can try to find some silver linings here. So let's start off, with Baidu. Baidu's ad revenue is down. There's not a whole lot to really be that happy about, but, James, you want to start us off with that?
Yeah, sure. So their MAU reached 307 million. 607 million, and that was up 12% year over year. They have this thing called daily logged in users, which I'm still kind of unsure what that is exactly counting. That got to 79%, which is the highest ever. Managed page as a percentage of revenue got to 43%. iQIYI subs are down a little bit to 104 million, which is below Tencent Video's around 129. Revenues for Baidu Core online marketing revenues are up 6% to 19.5 billion RMB. These are all RMBs and billions, if I'm not saying a percentage. And that's 79% of Baidu Core revenues. Non-online marketing revenues were up 76% to 5.2, so still a small piece. That's composed of two things: AI Cloud, which was up 73%, which is a slight acceleration to 3.8 billion RMB. And that means the other growth initiatives, which are like the, what do you call them? The like autonomous vehicle and some other things, that was up 75% to 1.4, still very small, but, you know, I think some comments on that, you know, while the online marketing revenues are slowing and likely to stay slow for a few quarters at least, I think that's kind of the commentary we got from everybody. You know, we are seeing AI cloud accelerate. That's kind of interesting, and that could be a very large business someday. And, you know, I saw today, actually, before we got on this recording, there was a press release that Baidu and Sanofi have signed some sort of license pact. Sanofi, I think, is the French biotech pharma, big, giant company. And it's on developing mRNA. Baidu, and I didn't know this, they have an mRNA design optimization platform, and I guess Sanofi is going to use that to try to optimize their mRNA drugs or vaccines, maybe. So I think big picture, just stepping back, I think Baidu Core has some real potential to start doing some big things. I do, and I might have said this in the past podcast, I do think that they're, you know, this AI expertise they've been building over the years that we've been kind of curious about, what is that and when's it going to happen? It looks like there's something happening there. This mRNA thing's interesting. I think AVs are still going to take a while, but in general, like this 2B enterprise AI solution cloud stuff, I think it could be very, very sticky. It takes a while to get to build up that kind of momentum. I think some commentary from the earnings call, you know, they're talking about how they have to, you know, when you're getting these new enterprises on board, you have to go visit them, you have to send people there, you have to sometimes tweak your design, your solutions a little bit to fit their exact needs and processes and get it in there. But once you're in, and once you've actually done that work, you've actually built and refined a little tiny part of a product that can work for similar companies, right? So they're now starting to, one of the comments they made on the earnings call is that they're starting to be able to productize this a little bit better. And so it's less in the kind of development sales phase. And now it's kind of past some of it's past that. So that's kind of promising. IGE subs, so they were down 1% year over year. Revenues were up 6%, kind of some mix between subs and advertising. Gross margin, 7%. They still have negative operating income. Their free cash flow is still negative. And in general, I mean, I don't have many comments here, but I'll just say, you know, the media business in China is not having a good time right now, to say the, you know, to put it lightly. And that's been going on for a while. It's not something that just started this summer, but it definitely, the heat got turned up a little bit this past summer. So, yeah, I think I'll leave it at that.
Well, just you know, looking at just the, you know, the Google chart here of their share price over the last year. So we're having this call on November 22nd, right? So November 23rd, 2020, the share price was $133. In February, it spiked up to over 300, and now it is back down to 151. So all those gains that Baidu shareholders were celebrating earlier this year have almost entirely been wiped out, unfortunately. But that's how things go. Michael, what are your thoughts on Baidu?
A couple of thoughts about the quarter before looking at some of the more future-facing elements. I'd just like to draw attention to the 50% year-on-year decline in operating income, which now sits at $577 million for the quarter. One of the reasons for this was some big increases in expenses. So Baidu's cost of revenue went up 26% year-on-year. SG&A expenses up 56% year-on-year. R&D expenses up 35% year-on-year. And then when we get to the EBITDA margins, for the quarter, they're at 19%. A year ago, prior corresponding period, they were at 32%. And as a result, the amount of EBITDA that Baidu generated for the quarter stood at around $925 million, down 34% year-on-year. Just going further down, net losses for Baidu sharply missed analyst estimates. And a big chunk of those losses included a substantial write-down in the fair value of Baidu's investment in Kuaishou. And so while there may be some top-line growth there, 13% year-on-year, once you look under the fold, you see some large increases in expenses, see some of the value of investments being written off, and things don't look very good for the bottom line. However, management commentary was that they're in a phase whereby they're investing in the future and that they would continue to do so. Looking forward to the future, Luo Rong, the CFO, made a comment that it's quite clear China will leverage technology to grow the enterprise and public sector portion of the market. And you can see with some of the contract wins that Baidu has been able to accrue for its AI cloud business, that that is coming to fruition. For instance, their smart transport solution called ACE has been adopted by 24 Chinese cities, and that's triple the number of cities that had been signed up this time last year. Apollo Go, that is their autonomous ride unit, has doubled the amount of rides that it's doing sequentially. Robin Lee, in a separate memo, claimed that Apollo Go did 115,000 autonomous rides in Q3, and according to Baidu, that makes it the world's largest autonomous driving service. Recently, Baidu has also partnered with Swiss Re, the insurance company, to provide risk management expertise and quote-unquote innovative insurance products for the autonomous driving business. And speaking of driving, the Apollo OEM partnerships, whereby the Apollo navigation tool comes pre-installed in the electronic dashboard of these new vehicles, is now up to 31 partnerships. And so it's quite clear that when it comes to customer acquisition, that they're making some inroads. And, of course, that this process of landing the client, adjusting the product, etc., may be one of the drivers of the increased cost in revenues over the period. That's all from me.
Yeah, our listeners will gonna recognize this point, because I think we've made it before, at least James and I have, is that we're a little more bullish on Baidu over the long term than we have been earlier. And I think that the all of these policies and regulations that have come out of Beijing over the last year or two does seem to benefit Baidu a little bit, in that a lot of these, you know, the I don't know how to say this, but the more substantive projects are looked upon more favorably from regulators, right? You know, when autonomous driving, all of these kind of 2G or two state sector contracts and business does seem to be something that will probably be more sustainable over the long term in China. I mean, this is my thinking, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But it's also still quite a cheap stock, if you look at, you know, its PE ratio and all of that. So yeah, that's my, you know, optimistic take on Baidu, is that, you know, for all the tech lash and all the concern over these Chinese tech companies, whether they be gaming companies or entertainment companies, you know, Baidu doesn't have to worry about that as much, because, you know, autonomous driving is something that I think, you know, the folks in Beijing, you know, really, really, really want to be, you know, encouraging going forward. So I do feel a little bit more positive about that. But yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Michael.
I mean, I'm still trying to get across all the different data regulation at play, which I assume in part touches and concerns Baidu. So while I'm getting up to school on that, while I'm getting up to speed on that, I won't make any substantive comments at this time. But once I've done my homework, then I can come back and perhaps talk about it at a later date.
Okay. Well, you will not respond to my speculation. You will wait until you are informed before you reply to my uninformed speculation. Okay. Well, let's move on to Tencent then. Michael, I guess you'll take the lead here. They're growing at their slowest rate in a long time, and that's also not very good news. So, Michael, what are your thoughts on Tencent?
Sure. So, looking at the top line first, revenue was up 13% year on year to 142.4 billion CNY, which is around 22 billion US dollars for those playing at home. Value-added services was up 8% year on year to 75.2 billion CNY. Value-added services consists of domestic games, international games, and social networks. Let me go through those in turn. Domestic games was up 5% year-on-year to 33.6 billion CNY. International games, noting that this is the first time that Tencent has broken out international games, was up 20% year on year to 11.6 billion CNY. And social networks was up 7% year on year to 30.3 billion CNY. Moving from VAS, value-added services, to the online ad segment, that was up 5% year on year to 22.5 billion CNY. Noting, of course, that there were some headwinds there, particularly around education, real estate, and the like, which are acting as a drag on online ad growth, which up until now had been fairly robust. Social advertising was up 7% year on year to 19 billion CNY, and fintech and other business services growing the most out of all the different business units, up 30% year on year to 43.3 billion CNY. Operating profit on a non-IFRS basis was up 7% year on year to 40.8 billion CNY, which is around 6.3 billion US dollars for those playing at home. And the quarterly profit was down 2% year on year. Just looking at a couple of key business highlights, at least from my standpoint, as a much smaller shareholder than I was at the start of the year, but nevertheless, there was some context and color around mini programs. Mini programs have increased 40% year on year. Music subscriptions through Tencent Music were up 38% year on year. Tencent have substantially complied with the implementation of measures to restrict minor gaming. So minors, as defined as those folks under 18 years old, spent 0.7% of total game playing time in Tencent's ecosystem. So that's less than 1%, down from 6.4% a year prior. Minor spend, so how much they're spending in-game, was 1.1% of Tencent's quarterly gaming revenues, down from 4.8% a year prior. And speaking of games, League of Legends Wild Rift is the second highest DAU game in China at this point in time. It's the highest new game in terms of DAUs. And Tencent's PaaS solution now has over 3,000 clients. That was the...
Did you catch the... was it the League of Legends World Championships a week or two ago? Did you see anything on that?
Was that Dota or League of Legends?
Oh, no, you're right. Was it Dota? No, I think it was League of Legends, wasn't it?
It was League of Legends. And League of Legends is kind of like a later Dota. I think it was League of Legends. Yeah.
But it was the short videos that I saw of like these college campuses where like these kids are going crazy, like they're, you know, like it's the US and they won, you know, their the Rose Bowl or something like that. It's it was pretty crazy how intense these Chinese kids were watching their esports teams.
Usually South Korea teams take the win there, and I think they have for the last couple of years. Is that right? I don't follow it that closely. Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I'd add to that, Michael, is they are also seeing a little bit of an acceleration in some expenses, like R&D expenses were up 39% year over year. Same with G&A, which that you have to take out the R&D expenses out of their G&A. It's also up 39%. A little slower from the quarter before, but still up. And their gross profit margins are, you know, everything, they're kind of staying steady. The thing that I'm kind of excited about with Tencent is that that growth in their fintech and business services makes me think that very soon fintech and business services will surpass internet VAS, or at least surpass online games, maybe not internet VAS, because that also includes social networks. But that, I think, is pretty interesting, especially because the gross margin there I mean, it's lower, but I think there's probably potential down the road for that to drift higher. It used to be drifting higher before this quarter, and it took a pretty sharp correction this quarter. And I think probably that's maybe due to some of the regulatory pushback that they've had. And I also think the big question on the call, I think, was about what their views are on regulations into the future. And it seems that they still expect more regulations, but the incremental impact will decline with time as companies adjust. But that doesn't mean that there won't be more or new implementations of the rules, the laws that have already been adopted this year. So I think that's kind of interesting. I am also still a shareholder.
You're so right, James, around the change in the revenue mix. And this is a recurring theme every time we do earnings, which is that the company that you were analyzing last year, whether it be Baidu, whether it be Tencent, whether it be Alibaba, whether it be Kuaishou, whatever, the revenue mix of all of these focus companies is changing. And so the company that you were analyzing last year is not the company that you're analyzing this year. And I think it's important for folks to keep an eye on the center of gravity for conglomerates like Tencent. You're absolutely right in saying that the center of gravity is moving. Just a couple of observations from the call from my end. I thought that James's comments on the macroeconomic...
James Mitchell, right?
Yes, correct. James...
Not James That's Hall, right. Just to be clear. Right.
Which is funny because my middle name is Mitchell.
Oh, goodness.
So it's even more confusing.
There you go.
All right. So 10 cents, James Mitchell.
Yeah, that's right. James Mitchell's comments on macroeconomic weakness and its drag on the ads business. James emphasized that the impact would be on several quarters, emphasis on several. The next nice bit from James, if you have the time, effort, and inclination, is to have a look at James's commentary around gaming and the positive externalities that gaming brings to China, namely that games result in some of the cutting-edge developments in hardware innovation, particularly what you can do now with GPUs. And also, James had a very interesting point that there are elements of China's entertainment business which are not conducive to export, such as films. And one of the possible cultural exports that China may be able to export successfully is indeed gaming. And James pointed out that of the top 100 games in the US, 20 of those come from Chinese companies. So it's just worth digging into his full comments around that. Martin gave some content and color around interoperability and Tencent's progress to date, noting, of course, that quite recently Alibaba has placed some public pressure on Tencent to do more. One of its business units claims that there is differential technical support when it comes to its mini programs as opposed to the mini programs of Tencent investees. And I was quite disappointed that on the call, many of the questions were what I would like to describe as softball questions. I have the utmost respect for the analysts, but there were a number of repetitive softball questions about the metaverse and some hard-hitting questions around interoperability, rumors around Tencent's tactical delay and obfuscation in this regard, and whether or not that would lead to compliance issues unaddressed, cannibalization with respect to Wild Rift's release, and, of course, Honor of Kings not addressed. So it's it was a little bit disappointing sort of listening to the call. You've got some very smart people on the line who are serving up some dare I say, dull questions to management. And so if you are an analyst that participated in that call or a colleague of said analyst, please send a rocket up their ass to get their act together on the next call. Love from Michael.
Michael really shots fired. But it's
throwing bombs over here.
I thought it was really interesting what you said, or what you said Martin said. Or what you said James Mitchell said about gaming and kind of its positive impact on kind of China's kind of global presence and its economic development and tech development. Because this is something that when we had Josh Ye on from South China Morning Post, he said something quite similar in that he was discussing. He was talking about how kind of the gaming kind of feeds into some of this core technology that is developed, and also kind of feeds into so many of these other areas of tech development. I think that that is, I don't know how much of that is like part of it. Like, I don't know how much of it is just like kind of the gaming industry's like pitch to regulators, and how much of it is something that that really there is substance to. There's probably a little bit of both, but it is something that is interesting, I think.
I think definitely driving GPU. I mean, before crypto mining, games were a major driver of GPU sales and technological development. So I think it's very true. But anyway,
anything else on Tencent?
On Tencent, no. I think the only other thing maybe I'll say is that I did a comparison of the three companies, and I looked at kind of their shares outstanding and their per share, you know, revenue and gross profit, operating profit, EBITDA or EBITA, and kind of compared their CAGRs. Tencent, I'll just say, over the time that I looked at, had the highest growth in terms of revenue and just about every financial metric I looked at on a per share basis. And while their market cap growth was quite a bit below most of those, the closest was operating cash flow and net profit and gross profit, but adjusted EBITDA was quite a bit above, revenue was quite a bit above, and net profit was quite even more above than revenue. And Baidu was kind of in the middle. They had the absolute lowest CAGR in terms of shares outstanding growth. And then they had kind of in the middle run, you know, sort of 12%-ish, you know, CAGR on revenue per share. Going down to operating profit, it dropped to 6%. And then because of, I think, mainly the problems with iQIYI and the changes they made in how they kind of figure out their free cash flow, which are the right changes, they added kind of licensing content and all that to there. That's actually negative CAGR on a per share basis for that stuff. And then if I can just close the loop here, Alibaba's had the largest share outstanding growth on a CAGR basis here. Revenue was quite high, 38%. And then I looked at gross profit, operating profit, and adjusted EBITDA. And those were in that order, 25, 14, and 12. And interestingly, you know, I went back to Q1 2018 here, historical market cap, and this is all in RMB. So there's some RMB conversion going on here, but the CAGR there was actually a negative 3.9%. So we've seen the EV to adjusted EBITDA for Alibaba go from 30 in Q1, and this is trailing, you know, 12-month adjusted EBITDA to enterprise value, go from 30 in Q1 2018 to currently 13, which is pretty outstanding kind of drop in a multiple there. Multiple compression.
Yeah.
Anyway, we can go into Alibaba now.
Yeah. Well, Alibaba, I don't know if I remember, you know, in the 3 years or so that we've done this podcast, ever seeing, yes, 3 years, yeah, 3 years, yeah, ever seeing an earnings report that was this kind of gloomy for one single company. Like, there was nothing but negative going around after Alibaba's earnings call. Who wants to take, James, you want to take this one first?
Yeah, I could just say a couple quick things. I think, you know, they mentioned on the call they have a GMV is still like around a trillion. They expect this slowdown to stick around for several quarters. And so that's kind of echoed by all three of these guys. You know, they mentioned several times they're investing in growth, and that's quality growth. They talked quite a bit about Taobao deals, which they called manufacturer to consumer, and going more for lower tiers there. And that's clearly going to compete with Pinduoduo, also because it's focusing more on produce and beverages and things that Pinduoduo has kind of, gone back to in its roots. You know, revenue was up 16% if you exclude Sun Art, because they began the Sun Art consolidation in October 2020, so you should kind of exclude that. CMR slowed down quite a bit to only 3% year-over-year growth, and that's down from 14% the prior quarter, which I think the lowest ever was March 2020, which was that March 2020 quarter, and that was COVID for China. So they're just above that. Commerce, which used to be called core commerce, EBITDA on a trailing 12-month margin down to a new low of 25%. Quarterly EBITDA margin was about 40 basis points above the low of 19% in March 2021 quarter. Let's see, Double 11, they also said GMV was about 540 billion RMB. They also mentioned that, you know, they're helping, you know, like they always say, small and medium-sized businesses. 65% of brands were SMEs, manufacturers from industrial belts and new brands. Community marketplaces grew GMV over 150%, and this is part of what Sun Art kind of plugged into, and they're using Sun Art's regional procurement and supply chain. They have about 285 million annual active customers internationally, and so that's Lazada, AliExpress, Trendyol, and Daraz, and I probably mispronounced those. There is kind of one of the big questions, I think, that's going to be, maybe we'll talk about this, but they, like, the first comments Daniel made were about the retail slowdown in the kind of general macro environment in China. And, you know, he said, in line with industry retail trends in China, physical goods GMV year-over-year growth rate moderated to a single digit this quarter, mainly due to slowdown in apparel and general merchandise categories. That said, growth rate of consumer electronics and home furniture in categories remain resilient. So these are the categories that kind of, at least consumer electronics, JD is the sort of leader in. You know, I think, it fits, you know, this retail slowdown kind of fits with, you know, what we're seeing in China's macro kind of information. There was an interesting chart out by, I think it was Pichet Asset Management, which shows that the retail slowdown, retail in China has not gotten anywhere back to trend, pre-COVID trend, and is quite a bit below it still. So we're kind of seeing that here. So the things to pull apart are, is Ali's kind of lackluster growth here, you know, this only 3% on your, you know, customer management, is this something that's, you know, just a little short-term blip problem, or is this a something that's fundamentally happened with their business, something's fundamentally changed? The other option besides this agreeing with this retail slowdown is maybe that there's, you know, I really can't help but think, I mean, all these like retail, so JD is kind of getting more 3P, right? And with Alibaba buying Sun Art and doing more of these, you know, new retail brick and mortar stuff, they seem to go more 1P, right? So they're kind of becoming each other in some way. So, you know, is there another deeper reason, which might be that there's some competitive forces or kind of forcing them to become more like each other to try to keep users and keep their annual active customers high and growing for fear of losing out, you know, even every quarter. I think it's like a daily battle, right? I mean, if you lose a customer one day, they go somewhere else to buy the same thing. You know, you just, you know, it's like literally, it's kind of zero sum on a just day-to-day, everyday basis. So fiercely competitive is probably another reason. But yeah, anyway.
2021, not a good year for Alibaba. Just looking at, I mean, we know there was the Jack Ma stuff, there was the Ant stuff, there was the antitrust investigation. The hits just kept on coming. But, you know, we talked about, I mentioned earlier, just looking at the share price of Baidu, you know, how it spiked in February and then kind of went back down. Now, Baidu is a $50 billion market cap company, right? Alibaba went from being at roughly $280 a share to almost exactly 1 year ago to now almost exactly half of that at $140 per share. But the difference between Baidu and Alibaba is that still Baidu is a $381 billion market cap company, which means that they lost roughly $380 billion in shareholder value. I mean, that's something. I mean, now like Microsoft and Google and you know, Apple have been going crazy, but this is like them, you know, losing half their value a couple, you know, at their, what their value was a couple of years ago. I mean, this is a big hit for a lot of shareholders, including myself. but not that big of a hit. I didn't have too much in it. But there's a reason why this is such big news. Because the market cap of Alibaba is substantial. And especially the losses that they have, you know, that their shareholders at least have now temporarily incurred or permanently incurred, have been tremendous. Michael, any thoughts on Alibaba?
So I tweeted on the day of the results that I know that I'm often seen as optimistic when it comes to contextualizing Alibaba's results, but this set of results makes optimism hard to come by. I since have calmed the down and will try and give the... the highlights, if you like, from both you and James have described, a disappointing earnings result. Look, management's emphasis is on multi-engine growth and continuing a thread that we had earlier in the podcast around just the revenue shift. I think it's just worth paying attention to where the money is coming from with respect to Alibaba now. So customer management revenue, which was, you know, north of 50-60% of Alibaba's revenue 24 months ago, now stands at 36% of their revenue in the third quarter. So that's the 3P business as a mental shortcut. The 1P business, their direct sales business, is now 27% of their revenue, and it grew at 111% year on year. Now, in an environment where there is single digit retail growth across the country, it strikes me that this 111% year on year growth is something pretty special.
Wait, hang on. So Q3 2020, the others, you know, I think is this direct retail, right? This was 26 billion. And then the following quarter, it was 51.7 billion. So it basically doubled from 26 to almost 52. And the reason that happened is because they acquired SunArt and consolidated it in Q4 2020. So if you had included SunArt in Q3 2020, I don't know what it would be, but I'm pretty sure it would be way below 111%, is my guess.
Yeah. So here, you're contextualizing that, you do have to take the SunArt acquisition into account. But of course, we're looking at the future, and the future is that SunArt's business is now a part of Alibaba.
But what I mean is the growth rate's going to be much slower.
I can certainly appreciate that. But the interesting transition, though, still remains this idea that the direct retail business is 27% of the revenue pie. Cloud is at 10, and it grew at 33%. What will be interesting for those who are following Alibaba is, of course, that they had a key customer loss in ByteDance, and now this 33% figure is important because it signals a return to cloud reacceleration. It remains to be seen, however, whether this can continue over a couple of different quarters or whether this is a blip. Cainiao Logistics, 5% of revenue, grew 20%. International retail is 5%. International wholesale is also 5%. So if we say that the international business is let's call it 10% of revenue, grew around 30%. So these, apart from the customer management revenue, these other elements of the business are growing at pace. The question is, though, for folks, seems to be around this customer management revenue. Was Alibaba over-earning previously? Now, with increased competition and worsening macroeconomic conditions, do we have to get adjusted to this idea of single-digit customer management revenue going forward? And why competition is important, because folks who follow the stock will be aware that Alibaba is subsidizing merchants as part of its common prosperity and reinvestment endeavors, which is a drag on the year-on-year revenue growth for that part of the business.
Yeah, they net out those subsidies. They mentioned it quite quickly on the call that they net those out of revenue. They're not coming out of anywhere else. And it's not like Pinduoduo, where they take them and they throw them into sales and marketing so revenue can still look nice and high growth.
That's right. And speaking of the business highlights, so we're talking often about this level of investment. Ali invested about 12 billion CNY extra in its business this year. And what is disappointing, I think, for investors is that when Ali is now talking about these investment units where it's redoubling efforts and it's trying to paint a picture of how they're doing, that they use different metrics. So, for instance, for the community group buying business, it grew 150% quarter on quarter in terms of GMV, but then for Taobao deals, they give us the accounts, the total number of active accounts for the local services. Uh-huh. They look at order volume. It's a real mess. So to the folks at Alibaba in investor relations, I know you listen to the podcast. Here is my humble suggestion. These are strategic investment priorities. You must step out to investors in a consistent way how you are evaluating the success of your investment. If it is GMV growth, then give us GMV growth consistently for all of these investment recipients. If it is GMV growth plus growth in accounts, then do that. Don't do what you're currently doing, which is, it seems to a cynical prick like myself, cherry picking the best numbers every quarter, because the question that's asked is, well, where's my 12 billion CNY going? And if I can't see where the payoff is across these different units in a consistent manner, it just seems like you've got something to hide. And instead, I would clearly lay it out, set out a new page in the pack, you know, update the pack. Don't be afraid to update the format such that you can show in a consistent manner, hey, community group buying added this much accounts, added this much in GMV. The international business added this much in GMV, this much in accounts. And think back to your peer competitor, Pinduoduo. What they did very well when they were telling their story was they listed the following consistently every quarter. One, GMV growth. Two, average spend. And three, the number of users. If you adopt a similar pro forma, folks will be able to see, and it will be abundantly clear, that Taobao Deals is the fastest growing e-commerce app in China e-commerce history. At the moment, you are not getting the benefit of that narrative because you're cherry-picking particular stats. The international business, for instance, 285 million annual active accounts. Well, in terms of annual active accounts, that is on par with Amazon. You have the opportunity to tell the story that our international business is as large as Amazon by customer accounts. But you're not doing that. And so this is where it is such an easy win if you are able to change this pro forma. I look forward to the Investor Day, and I hope the materials get a lot better than what they are. This slide 7 in the presentation pack.
This is a free podcast, Alibaba Investor Relations.
Yeah, seriously. I agree with all that. I mean, I will say they did mention on the call that they plan on stating some of those metrics and how they evaluate their businesses at the Investor Day. It would be nice to see some sort of uniformity amongst those. And I mean, they don't have to say, you know, they stopped giving, you know, Taobao, Tmall, GMV all a long time ago. And now you can get it annually sometimes. But they used to do it on a quarterly basis. And you know, you can stop once it gets big, but you want to highlight that growth. And you know, I can understand from an operating perspective, as someone who worked in IR in a company before, there is kind of a little bit of management fear about, you know, okay, we're making these investments, we don't know if they're going to work out. If they don't work out, you know, how's the market going to react to that? And so there's worries about that. And I think you could say the same thing about all this with Baidu, to be honest. Tencent does a fabulous job giving their data, especially in that quarterly metrics Excel file on their IR page, by the way. Fantastic. But, you know, I think Baidu could do the same thing. You know, let's see some uniformity, you know, instead of dropping, you know, suddenly dropping metrics that you used to give and without any reason. You know, there's so many of those with all these companies.
But they got to get those Y Combinator headlines, right? whatever is the best in the quote, whatever, you know, whatever will look good when you do the Google search.
Well, that's right. The other thing that I'd like to see as I continue my rant is give us a future state of the revenue mix.
Sorry, not Y Combinator, Seeking Alpha. That's what I meant. Yeah, sorry. SA, not YC. Sorry, that's my point.
Just a desired state for the revenue for the revenue mix. Why do I say that? Is because the story that you're trying to tell is that we're an institution when it comes to commerce in China. We have the best pool of customers. We're able to serve our customers online, offline, omni-channel, And as a result, our reliance on customer management revenue is going to decrease over time because the marketplace, Taobao Tmall, is just one part of our business now. And so what I'd like to see is movement towards a target state, a desired state where you can sort of lead investors to say, hey, when it comes to 2023, we think cloud is going to be, let's say, 20% of our business. And we think international is going to be 15%. We think logistics is going to be 10%. And then we can sort of see, okay, well, we shouldn't be too worried about customer management revenue because as a proportion of revenue, that's going to shrink from 36% today to 25% in 2 years' time or whatever it may be. And it's just another way to be able to contextualize the achievements that the company is making towards multi-engine growth. At the moment, the core reason, I think, for the multiple compression, apart from the regulatory action, is this idea that Alibaba is being disrupted left, right, and center. And so to be able to get in front of that and combat that, you need a consistent format for these new businesses to be able to see, hey, we've got some pretty exciting stuff happening under the hood, but also the Alibaba of yesterday will not be the Alibaba of tomorrow. We're going to be more international. We're going to be less reliant on the marketplace, and we're going to be serving our consumers in different ways. So if they can make those changes after Investor Day for future announcements and presentations, I will be much happier than what I am at the moment.
So just going back, if you look at this core commerce, whatever they're calling it now, the adjusted EBITDA, so no D in there, margin on a trailing 12-month basis back in like the 2016s, 2017s, was over 60%. Now, you know, you can't say it's not from at least some competition, but I think with some competition, JD coming in on 3P to some degree, Pinduoduo hasn't been able to really do much with brands, but, you know, coming in on the lower tiers and grabbing users there. And then because they did that and everyone was like, oh my God, look at them, and they got a pretty amazing, you know, valuation and their growth was outrageous. Everyone started doing that too. And they went for this lower tier thing, and that brings down your margins. Mm. And so now we're looking at on a trailing 12-month basis, adjusted EBITDA clocked in at 25%. So we're looking at, you know, I chart these things and I look at it and it's just like this, it's a very steady decline. What has a very nice, very slow, but very nice increase, you know, from negative to positive, even though it's very minor, is cloud computing. You know, now it's at 1.5% on a trailing 12-month basis, which is great. Last quarter was the first time it went positive on a TTM basis. Digital media and entertainment, like we said with iQIYI, you know, it's a tough business right now. I do think they're probably doing something there, but they probably, you know, they can't really talk about it. But I think they're probably active in some of these things. That's another thing that's kind of weird about this summer and this year is that, you know, because regulators have such a tight look on what's going on and what these guys are doing, they kind of have to also be careful about what they say, right? And how they highlight how great they are. I mean, it's almost like you don't want to highlight it too much because everyone's focusing on antitrust. So I can kind of, you know, from that perspective, I can kind of understand why they might not want to do it. But from an investor's point of view, and this is like where, you know, you have to share some information, and obviously regulators can see everything that the investors see and more. But, you know, it would be nice to have, I mean, Alibaba is just a massive company with so many things going on. Have some sort of just rework how you describe the business. And I think, like Michael said, focusing on that end, you know, after the dust settles, what does this look like? you know, 5 years down the road, how big are you, do you want to get internationally? Is that going to be, you know, will it get to 50% of where China is, you know, or is this something you're going to just do a couple countries in Southeast Asia, you know, 4 or 5 countries, and then you're going to do Turkey, where's the other one? And then you're going to call it quits, or are you going to kind of keep expanding? So, I mean, there's a lot of, like, what's the long-term view? It'd be very, very interesting to see. And I think, you know, as a very small shareholder, I've recently made a position, but, you know, I think there's obviously a lot they could do, you know, going forward. It is kind of sad, though. I mean, this core commerce business was incredible why it lasted, you know. I mean, like, you know, 62% EBITDA margins kind of put a target on your back, though. And I think that's what we've witnessed. But, you know, if they can keep this CAGR revenue per share growing at over 30% and eventually, you know, work out the profitability and get it kind of in a nice place, you know, that'd be fascinating. But everyone's going to have this problem. It's the competition's not going away. And that's the problem with online stuff, right? It's like the cost of switching my app to, you know, a different e-commerce app, especially when payments and everything's opened up, just gets lower and lower and lower. Right? It's great for consumers. But anyway, yeah.
A lot of these companies that already had very thin margins, you know, now, you know, those margins that were thin are often going away, and like their plans, their roadmaps to profitability are often going away. So that is a rough thing for shareholders. Do you guys want to get into some of the questions here?
Oh yeah.
All right. I'll start off with the first one. This is replying to Michael's tweet asking for questions. I'm gonna read the first one here. And the reason why I say it first is because the guy said he's a big fan. So from Andrew. So we've talked a lot about on the podcast about the bringing down of the quote unquote walled gardens for these tech platforms. So what he's asking about is, among the three here, who is best positioned for interoperability, right? Baidu can search Tencent content, a more open environment for e-commerce, or Tencent can monetize more as envisioned by their management due to their relatively high engagement to monetization. So which company do you think here might be benefiting most from the increased interoperability of these platforms? Either one of you guys can take this.
I'll just say the name. I think Tencent has a lot to benefit from. I'd put them first probably, but to be honest, it's Why? Really a lot to be seen. Just because I think they have that, it's really the engagement, having users in their ecosystem every day, just chatting with other users, I think is a major benefit. And they're also going into business services and doing some they're doing, I mean, if you compare their enterprise stuff that they're doing compared to Baidu, for example, and the same for Alibaba, it seems like Tencent and Alibaba are doing more kind of like SaaS, you know, like software stuff. So like word processing, Ding Talk, you know, WeChat, business chat, you know, kind of stuff. Whereas Baidu's sort of doing kind of more nitty gritty, deep into the business, you know, type stuff. You know, they talk about like going to visit these industrial manufacturers and like getting into like a part of their process and trying to add some AI or, you know, some sort of machine learning to that piece of the process, right? That's like very, very intensive amount of work to do that. And then once you're in there, kind of you don't just pull that out of your system. But, you know, I think there's so on one hand, I think Tencent and Ali in that sense get to grow a little faster. But I feel like Baidu, once they reach that, you know, once they figure out all these things and productize them, I think they'll have quite a lot of tailwind. But back to this, I totally dodged the question, but back to this, I mean, I think Tencent is growing quite well on e-commerce. There's still a lot of, I know Michael has a lot of comments about that. You're always tweeting about, you got to look at Tencent when you look at e-commerce. There's a lot happening there. And there's just there's a lot of users. And if Tencent Pay or WeChat Pay can get onto Alipay, Alibaba, and be a competitor there and just about everywhere, I think that's pretty positive for them. Yeah. I mean, I think flip it around a little bit. Who's least, in the worst position of the three? You know, I kind of think it's hard to say that Baidu search is going to really kick off just by being able to access and index, other walled garden content. It's possible.
Yeah, that was my question. But with Baidu, yeah.
Yeah, it's possible, but I don't know, because what the key benefit of Tencent is that you're like in the app already. You know, maybe there's like a collab thing where Baidu can work with Tencent and offer a search inside WeChat or something. I mean, Tencent did just take Sogo private, so chances of that are maybe low. But, it's like China, Ray Ma actually had a good comment about this. China is not like a place, it's not like America where people, when they first think of something, they go to Google and type it in, or go to Amazon and type in the product and read some reviews. You know, it's not a search first kind of market. It's a discover first, right? So it's all feed. It's your short video feed. You watch what other people are doing and you have some ideas, because it's like that initial, spark is not quite there as much, I guess. I don't know why this is. I think there's some theory that maybe there's some difference in kind of educational attainment for people in China. It only goes compulsive education is only to ninth grade, and then you have to pass a test to get to high school. So anyway, I've been talking too much. Michael, what do you think?
Passive versus active, yeah.
So, whenever we're talking about interoperability, I think it's helpful to talk in terms of net beneficiaries. I agree that Tencent will be the biggest net beneficiary, and my reasoning is pretty well documented online. I think when we're talking about interoperability, we have to be conscious of the different money piles. So for my mind, there's three money piles in play: e-commerce, digital advertising, and payments. Payments is bigger than e-commerce, which is bigger than digital advertising. And so don't just watch the players, but also watch the money piles. Which money piles are being reordered? What is the extent to which they're being reshuffled? These are all interesting things to look forward to as we go on, but my top line view is that Tencent is the biggest net beneficiary. Let's go to the next question.
Who's the least biggest net beneficiary, you think?
The other B, ByteDance.
Mm.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Mm.
Put simply, ByteDance's next act will be in e-commerce, and the issue here is that if I have a Douyin account under interoperability, why do I have to sign up to Douyin shops for my e-commerce presence? I can hang my Taobao Tmall link within the description, and by rights, you have to allow that link to open up in-app, whereby you complete the purchase.
But by the way, this is how it's done now. I mean, these guys, they all bring you, actually they bring people into WeChat groups.
Yes.
And then they move you to your Baidu, the Tmall or Taobao store.
And so this is what I think throttles ByteDance's e-commerce ambitions. Noting, of course, that ByteDance has had a pretty horrible year insofar as it's been cock-blocked in education with the relevant regulations there, and perhaps also in gaming as well, where you've got additional time and content and perhaps some monetization obstacles to contend with. So it certainly hasn't had a very good year either. And one of the reasons why it's not talked about as much is that, of course, it's not a public company and we can't see that stock price sort of collapse in on itself. But that's another topic for another time.
But then also, I mean, the other question is with the new regulations, how much more difficult is it going to be for them to IPO when it's time to IPO? But anyways, let's move on to another question. So this is from Alex Pitti. The most obvious question is when the government will stop announcing new regulations, or is this a new normal? You know, what's going to happen? And I think, Michael, the clarifying question that you gave after that was, I think, indicative, I think, of a lot of kind of the conversation as well. It's kind of your own point just in the question that you asked, which is, what regulation do you mean, right, related to data, content, competition, or something else? And then he asked about thinking with Tencent, you know, maybe video games in particular. But do you have any thoughts on this? And, you know, do you have in different kind of baskets how, you know, that we may see the end in some kind of regulation, but maybe other kinds of regulation will be, you know, just beginning?
Yeah, great question. So I thought it was a tall order to ask governments to stop regulating stuff just so you can have investment clarity. So that's why I asked the clarifying question of what is it specifically? And what I listed out, I think, is indicative of where my mind is at the moment. Is it data, content, competition, or something else? And in data, I'm going to include both privacy and also algorithmic regulation as well, just for those who are playing at home. I think that these, as we close out 2021 and look to 2022, are going to be the big three still next year. I don't think that there will be any sign of easing when it comes to data regulation, whether that is personal privacy, whether that is targeting, retargeting, algorithmic regulation. You can assume that that's going to continue. When it comes to content regulation, you saw this year a mix of both solving specific issues, such as minor gaming time, as well as broader cultural issues, sort of particular styles of character, particular aesthetics coming under fire. I see some tweaking.
Getting rid of the sissy men.
Yes, I see some tweaking when it comes to content regulation. Going forward, I think there will be less smut. I think there will be less effeminate game characters. I think there will be less visible foreign influence in game, film, and anime content. When it comes to competition, I am expecting, although I could be hilariously wrong, I am expecting caps on take rates for platforms. So this is something that I'm thinking about, is that one of the challenges that China thinks that these digital platforms pose is that once they've got themselves in a winner-take-all or winner-take-most position, then there is no ceiling to which that they can charge both consumers and merchants. And so I think there will be caps on take rates. This also makes some sense if you think about the current macroeconomic context. The economy's not that great. We wish to curb extractive practices. And that means, DD, that you cannot take more than 20% of a ride fare. Or you, Meituan, cannot take X percent of the sales commission, and you cannot charge more than X percent of sales for marketing dollars, whatever it may be. So I don't think that this is going to be a static environment. If anything, this year the easy stuff was done. That is to say, unfair competition forced exclusivity, licensing deals that are monopolistic. I think that those, by comparison, are low-hanging fruit. What's harder is things like platform take rates, algorithmic recommendation regulation, interoperability, and these are all unresolved issues at the end of 2021. So heads up, at least if you're living in my head, this is not going away. And if anything, next year you will see continuation of regulation, and it's just that the topic, the subject matter, gets more technical, more challenging, and so we need to have our wits about ourselves as we head into 2022.
The only thing I'd say to Alex's question, which is just slightly different, he's just, you know, asking when they will stop announcing new regulations. I mean, we might see a slowdown for a while because they did just announce a ton of stuff. And or not just now, some of it was draft laws for a while, and they're like getting brought up and getting enacted. What we're gonna see a lot of is the details of those laws get worked out, right? And so there's gonna be, and there might still be like state media criticism articles that sound like they're regulations, but it's really just someone who's kind of butthurt in state media, you know, complaining about something. And by the way, they might have been doing that for years, but now people are paying attention to it. So anyway, I think we'll see, you know, more. It'll come down to implementing, how these things are implemented, how they're enforced. You know, we saw recently a bunch of these antitrust kind of penalties were given to, you know, a bunch of big tech companies. And, you know, they had to pay a lot of fines. Each one was like 500,000 RMB, but there was a lot of them and they add up. And so if they kind of keep going that way and keep finding these small things, these small infractions, and just keep, you know, pestering them and charging them for them, you know, that might stick around for a while until they go, yeah, maybe we should try to stop this and figure out why we keep doing these things. And that also might not be an easy thing to figure out, right? So, you know, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, China is just, I mean, for these tech companies, and we're only talking about them here, but there's probably the next wave of regulations are probably not going to be in tech. They're going to be in other areas. I think some really big ones, and it could be related to data, could show up in healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing a lot of these, and
probably
these
more in real estate
tech
too.
Platforms. Real estate, maybe not so much, just because the market's gotten kind of tough, and now the PBOC seems to be trying to get banks to lend to real estate and property, to give more property loans. So that might be a little slower, but I think healthcare, we might even see, I mean, we're seeing the beginnings of potentially a pullback in some of this stuff. You know, it won't ever be quite said that way, but I think some, you know, they might allow some education, after school education companies to operate. Now they might not be profitable for profit businesses, but that maybe could change too. I mean, the norm in China is change. You know, all this stuff can change. Everything can change. So yeah, I think we're gonna see, I think Q4, I mean, just in general, it seems from Beijing, my position here, and people I meet, it seems like there's a lot of people who aren't very busy, and everyone's kind of, you know, taking work less seriously, just not doing too much for perhaps like a keep your head down, lay low sort of way, mm-hmm. in the fact that if you don't do things, you can't really get in trouble for doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there we might see in the next quarter, maybe next two quarters, a pretty significant slowdown in just general economic activity, which if that happens, I think the government will have to listen to some of the people who are on the finance kind of econ side of the, you know, the regulatory officials. So anyway, that's...
But that... That would kind of segue into another question that another listener had here. Rob asked he asked three questions, but I just want to ask, take one of them here. He asked for your thoughts on declining ROIC, whether this is transient or a function of scale or something, he says, more sinister or more, I guess, maybe more long term or more bigger picture or a new normal, like you said. James, do you guys have any thoughts on that?
So ROIC is return on invested capital. And I think what he's talking about is just in general profitability of investments that these big platforms are making seems to be declining. And I think that's true. Is it transient or a function of scale? So if it's a function of scale, it'd be just because there's such much bigger platforms now. That could be the case. Transient would mean that they would revert at some point. So I don't know. So the way returns go back to some sort of nice, high steady rate is you have declining competition in your industry. You have some consolidation. This is like Marathon Capital is famous for kind of putting this theory out there. But you have some sort of consolidation among industry players. As after they consolidate, they stop making investments that don't return, have good return, right? And that creates a sort of stabilized, normalized group. It's usually you have less than four players. Sometimes it's two or three. It can't be one because then you have a monopoly and then you're going to have problems with that. So you need like kind of a steady state where everyone sort of agrees to stay in their area. So like, for example, in the community group buying, I said this on a podcast a little while ago, in the community commerce, if all the players and platforms agreed to kind of by county, kind of divvy up the country, then you could see, I think, interesting margins come out of that. But if they don't agree, what you're going to see is a lot of cash burning and fighting and potential, losses for a long time until some people run out of money and have to pull out or get acquired. And I think we've already started to see that this year, some of them running out of money and just giving up. So, that you have to see something like that. So I don't think it's going to be transient just because the focus on antitrust, it would be very hard, I think, for competition to decline in China because it seems like the government's trying to keep it high, which is a good thing to do. It's great for consumers. It's great for innovation in general, but it's just not that great for investment, for investors. I don't think it's something more sinister. I don't know what that would be, but I don't think it's something more sinister. Yeah, those are my thoughts there.
Michael?
So I'll have two very quick comments. The first, when it comes to lower returns, and we're coming back to Alibaba, I think, because it's a nice example. Doing things digitally, so matching supply and demand, and then taking a cut of a transaction that you did by matching supply and demand, a pure digital business model has great economics, great returns, and the like. The problem is that many of these players are now more than just a matching layer between supply and demand. They're not a thin sort of layer that sits on top of supply and demand. Instead, they're an edifice that owns physical inventory, operates stores. In JD's case, even opened a mall now under its own name. And so what you have is you have these platforms that are often described as e-commerce players, but perhaps a more realistic label is that they are omni-channel retailers. And all of them, whether it is Ali, JD, or Pinduoduo, now engage in both a marketplace business and also a direct sales retail business. And so what you have is you have a changing investment and return profile based on that transition. At the moment, it's not enough for you to be just a thin interfacing layer between supply and demand. And I don't think that that is transient. I think that that continues forward. The next thing is that watch out for regulation. And I mean, I talked about sort of caps on take rates. Other things, if you look at Europe, and Europe have proposed a digital tax, if this sort of idea was to be transplanted to China, it may materially change the investment profile of some of these companies. And so there are a number of ways in which regulators around the world are toying, are thinking about how to make the playing field more even, and in some cases, particularly, you know, a proposed digital tax. My personal opinion is, not that it matters, is that it is an overreach. But ideas are contagious. They can be transplanted to other jurisdictions to serve particular ends. And if they are, then please have that in the back of your mind as you consider the potential returns that a digital business in China may be able to throw off, given if it is subject to, one, a digital tax, and two, has upper limits placed on take rates. It would change the investment thesis for a number of digital businesses. So, yeah.
If I can just make a quick comment on that, if that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm part of the reason I think, I mean, when I look at what governments do, I tend to think that they're somewhat rational. It doesn't always seem that way, but it seems like, you know, the EU with doing this digital tax, they don't have as many digital companies as, say, the US. So the cost to, you know, the EU's businesses, and therefore the opposition to it, is less. Now, the problem and the reason why I agree with you, Michael, it's not a good idea, is because if the EU wants to have more digital businesses, having a tax that has no like limits, you know, there should be some sort of, like, if you're over this many users or this much revenue, so like smaller companies can still do it. And I think similar things are happening when you look at the way China regulates their businesses. A lot of these regulations, you would just never see them even discussed or get very far in other countries like the US, where there's quite a bit, you know, for example, on data, it's just much harder for the US to talk about, you know, data privacy when, you know, US corporations have the vast majority of data on people around the world through Facebook and WhatsApp and, you know, these global platforms with billions of users. So having that come from a U.S. law, like lawmakers, would be kind of shocking. But yeah, so I think there is some sort of geopolitical sort of, you have to look at like what each country's businesses are, kind of their strengths and their competitive advantages. And it's not like these are real competitive advantages. They're more fluid, but they have been built over time and they've gotten large. So by merit of scale, they become an advantage, right? They're not like actual, you know, advantages where physical things are in that country that can't be somewhere else, you know, for stuff like that.
Yeah, there's just, I mean, on, this is November 22nd, just today, there was a piece by Naoki Matsuda in Nikkei. The headline is, China considering a data tax on big tech? Signs point to yes. And she cites that a key party member says profits earned on information belong to all, not just companies. But anyways, I suggest reading that article. But yeah, I mean, it does seem like that's
fascinating.
That's a possibility.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyways, we've been doing this for about an hour and a half, so we probably should wrap it up. Yeah, sorry to those who we weren't able to answer your questions. You know, we'll keep in touch. We'll try to answer them, or maybe we'll have a special Q&A episode or something like that. But anyways, Michael, James, anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
I mean, it's already an hour and a half. We should probably. Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
No, that's all right. The last thing that I wanted to say is that it's important to take these into context. We recorded on November the 22nd. There are another bunch of companies that are reporting in, you know, interesting verticals like e-commerce, like video entertainment and the like. So when you're contextualizing these less than impressive results in some instances, put it in a broader context. How did the other companies do? Is it a sector problem? Is it a structural problem? Are there issues with the economy? These are all things that you should be thinking about.
Agreed.
All right. And Michael, how can everyone follow you on social media?
Brief Norris on Twitter for all your dour notes about companies that you should avoid.
All right. And James, how can I follow you?
James Hull X on Twitter as well. And I'm not very active. I'm much less active than you two.
And I'm at Elliot Zagman, ELLIOTTZAAGMAN. And you can follow me for all my complaining about DC drivers in Washington, D.C. or D.C. and Maryland drivers. That's what I've been tweeting about this weekend. But anyways, thanks to you guys. Thanks to our listeners. And thanks to our to the folks at TechNode for making this happen. And you can catch us all next time on the China Tech Investor Podcast. Bye-bye now.